Delighted to welcome with us Williams Bay High School. Would the students please stand from Williams Bay? Good to see you all. You may be seated. And we also have students from Appleton East Senior High School. Would they please stand, please? Glad to see you this morning, too. You may be seated.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The students are with us with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and State Bar of Wisconsin. That program is a national award-winning program, and students from around the state are invited to join us for oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, briefs of these cases have been sent to the students. And then as part of the program, the students meet with a justice of this court after this second case of oral arguments. And today, the students will meet with Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who sits to my immediate left. And while I'm introducing Justice Bradley, I'll introduce the rest of the court. To her left is Justice David Prosser, and to the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his immediate right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case, 03-1444CR, State v. Christopher Anson. And arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Christopher G. Wren, whom we just saw yesterday in argument.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Delighted to be back. My name is Christopher Wren. I am an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I appear on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, which is the plaintiff respondent petitioner in this case. This case is in its second route trip through the appellate system, but the first time here, and we're part of what we want to do, I think, is figure out what Anson, the first Anson case means, whether it was properly applied here. What the state would like the court to do in this case, in its decision, is reverse, for the most part, the Court of Appeals, and hold that the circuit court conducted a proper Harrison-Middleton hearing, and that the state satisfied its burden of proving that Mr. Anson would have testified despite the use of the illegally obtained statements, and would have repeated the substance of the suppressed statements.
Mr. Wren, let me just stop you right there with respect to the, quote, Harrison-Middleton hearing.
Sure.
I look at United States versus Harrison. And in Harrison, the court made its determination based upon the facts that were in the record. There was no separate hearing to determine that. I look at State versus Middleton, and the court remanded it for a determination. Let me get the exact wording. Remanded it to the trial court to make the determination as to whether there was a Harrison violation. But I don't see anything in the Middleton decision that says that it remands it for purposes of an evidentiary hearing. Is it supposed to be done on the basis of the record and that it's already established, or is there anything to indicate that under Harrison-Middleton you get a separate evidentiary hearing?
Well, that's perhaps part of the issue of both Harrison and Middleton don't set up any procedural issues for resolving this. Our position would be, even if you simply rely on the record that existed, that the record that existed, as recounted by the prosecutor in this case, shows that Mr. Anson would have testified. And, in fact, that's what the court's finding was. Judge Carlson said that the distinguished reason, which is the standard that Harrison sets out, the distinguished reason was all the witnesses that testified set up a sufficiently compelling case that Mr. Anson would have had to testify to rebut it. Otherwise, the proof of the state would have stood unrebutted.
But now, isn't the Harrison analysis twofold? One, whether the defendant would have testified, and two, whether he would have testified as he ultimately did?
That's correct. Whether he would have repeated the statements that were found in the illegal or the suppressed statements or the statements that should have been suppressed. Yes, that's the second part of it. And In this case, what, as the prosecutor again told the court, and I, and as I believe Judge Carlson held, he would have stated that. He would have, there would have been no way he could have avoided those statements coming in again for two reasons. One is, if he had testified, which is the first step to get over, if he had testified, he would have either made those statements directly during his direct testimony in order to remain consistent with his story that he'd been telling his wife and that he'd been telling other people, apparently. If he'd said that on direct, if he had not said that on direct, it would have come in on cross-examination through the prosecutor bringing those in and raising questions about his credibility. So either way, it would have come in.
So are you saying that the statements about the location of the touching, about the lying to the wife, would have come in under cross-examination?
Because if he had said that he had, if he had said what he told his wife, the prosecutor would have brought in the statement to the office that he made out in Orange County saying, no, she actually touched the other part.
But why would he have said what he told his wife?
I think for consistency at that point.
I understand.
The alternative would have been that he would have had to say what actually happened, which was what he told the officer out in Orange County. There were only two possibilities for what he would testify about that incident. He could not avoid testifying about that incident. Part of the reason he couldn't have avoided testifying about that incident is because there were multiple counts here. This is quite different from Harrison, where Harrison there was only one count and the victim was dead. Here you have a victim who was alive, got up, testified, had supporting witnesses testifying about not only this particular incident that was the subject of the statement that should have been suppressed, but also testifying about other incidents. He did not have the option of simply getting up and testifying about only the incidents that were not part of that statement. If he got up and testified to rebut two of the counts, he would have had to have testified one way or the other, either on direct or cross, about the third incident.
What about the lying to the wife business? I don't quite see how that would have come in. I mean, say he gets up and he testifies that the touching was consistent with what he told the officers. Doesn't have to go any further, does it?
He doesn't, but on cross-examination it comes in.
Why?
Because they want to go with a credibility question. What he's saying is, if his testimony, if he uses the line that he told his wife, is inconsistent with what the victim is saying.
But just assume he's gonna be consistent with what he told the officers. Then why would what he told his wife ever come in? I mean,
we aren't concerned about what he told his wife. We're concerned about what he told the officers. So if he says what he told the officers, then that's what is at issue here, whether he would have repeated what he told
them. Well, it was also the lying to the wife. That was part of what was brought out.
It was brought out, but that was not the subject of the suppression. That was not the illegal statement. He told his wife. The statement that was suppressed and that was illegally admitted was the statement that was made to the officers in Orange County, California.
Right, but part of that was he told them that he had lied to his wife.
Right, that's correct.
All right.
But he told them that different story, which was consistent with what the victim was saying. And so if he gets up, the question under Harrison and Middleton is whether he would have repeated what he told the officers when he got up. So if he gets up and he testifies to the same thing he told the officers, then that's not a, then it's
you're too general for me. He told the officers about touching. He told the officers about the time of touching. He told the officers about lying to his wife.
Right.
So those are the things that bother me. Am I confused about the record that they were not part of the trial? All of those things?
All those things were part of the trial, yes.
Okay. So all of them were attempted to be suppressed because everything he said to the officers was part of the suppression motion that was improperly denied, correct?
Right.
Okay. So I understand your position about the touching and the location of the touching. What still concerns me is how on cross you would get in the length of time of the touching and that he lied, that he told the officer he lied to his wife.
Because once you get in any part of that statement, the rest of the statement becomes available to the prosecutor to use on cross to get out the rest of the testimony. He's not privileged to to speak only about part of that statement.
Why does he have to speak about the statement at all? I mean, can't he just be asked by his lawyer what happened? And he tells, okay? Now, if that's inconsistent
right.
with something he told the prosecutors, fine. But if his lawyer never asked him, what'd you tell your wife, and how long did the touching go on, we don't get to that, do we?
I guess we must be talking past each other.
Because
I don't remember. The issue for Middleton is, would he have repeated the statement?
That's the second part. It's content-based. Right.
The content part of it.
Right.
And so the prosecutor should not have used the statement. If it had not used the statement, would he have still testified? If we say yes, then the question is, what would he have said when he testified?
Right.
Either on direct or on cross.
Right.
So he gets up and he's got this third count to deal with. He's got the first two counts to deal
sure,
with.
Sure, sure.
He can say nothing about the third count, theoretically, he can say nothing about the third count and leave that testimony unrebutted.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem logical.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
So then he has to testify about that third account. What does he tell about that third account?
Yeah.
He can tell three things. He can say, I lied to my wife.
Why would he ever say that?
He doesn't. That's one of the things he could testify about that's in the statement that's been suppressed.
Yeah.
The second thing is he could say what he told his wife, which was she took my hand and put it on her breast. That's what he told his wife. That's not what he told the officer.
But why would he say that? I mean,
he has to say something about the third account.
We'll just assume he's going to be truthful when he's up there.
Okay.
So he's going to say where the touching was, which was
right.
not on her breast, but on the vaginal area. Okay.
Right.
So I guess I'm having trouble understanding how we ever get to the lie to the wife if he's truthful on the stand.
We don't have to lie to the wife. What we want is the confirmation of the victim's testimony, which was on the vagina.
So you want the statement in.
We want the content of the statement, and what I think Justice Rosenstock is saying, he's going to give that on direct. That's the point.
Yeah.
If he testified, he would have testified about it.
Mr. Wren, isn't there a step that you're missing in all of this? My understanding is that if a statement is suppressed, that it might be available for use on cross-examination if the defendant testifies under Harris versus New York, if there is a determination by the court that that statement is trustworthy in nature. Was that ever made? Is that part of the record here?
I don't know that that was made specifically. It was suppressed because there was a Sixth Amendment violation, not because there was a Fifth Amendment violation. I don't think there's been any challenge to the trustworthiness of that at all.
Well, let's just go back.
Don't you have to have that determination before you can say that that statement would have been available for cross-examination of the defendant?
Well, if you have to have that, then what they didn't have, there was no indication in Harrison and Middleton that that was going to be part of this process, that determination had been. I think, at least I believe the prosecutor was operating on the assumption. She and I have talked about this, and we never discussed the issue of the trustworthiness aspect of it, because I think there was an assumption that as a Sixth Amendment violation, there was no question that he'd come in and talk voluntarily with the officers. It had just been a violation of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
That isn't the test. My understanding is that if a statement is suppressed before that statement can be used, even on cross-examination of a defendant who testifies, the court has to determine under Harris versus New York that the statement is trustworthy in nature and therefore can be used to cross-examine. And my question is, I think you're missing a step in all of this.
Well, if we're missing a step, then I think the appropriate thing to do, and if you believe that undermines what the trial court did here, the appropriate thing to do is to remand it for a determination of that issue with that standard in place. The prosecutor did argue to Judge Carlson, that this would have come in whether on direct or through her cross-examination. The court accepted that. I mean, in that finding, you could make the assumption that it was an implicit finding of trustworthiness, but there was no specific argument on trustworthiness. The trustworthiness issue was not raised at all in this post-conviction hearing.
If I can, I've got one other question. Where is the burden, once you've got the Harrison-Middleton determination, where is the burden? Is it on the state to prove that he would have testified anyway?
Yes, it's quite clear that the burden of a production of some, well, the burden already exists on the state because of the underlying illegality of using the statement. The burden exists there. If your question is what the burden of proof is on the state, what burden of the state has to satisfy, neither Harrison nor Middleton really says what that burden is. Judge Carlson here said that he was making his finding to proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
As to what?
As to the harm he characterizes as harmlessness.
Isn't the proof whether he would have testified or not?
Yes, I think that's correct. And that gets to an issue that has not been addressed anywhere else in these proceedings. Again, this
Let
is
me just of, double back.
Okay.
Just for because this relates to Justice Crooks' question. In this case, defendant moves to suppress his statements.
Correct.
Trial court says no.
Correct.
Defendant tries to get to the Court of Appeals on an interlocutory appeal.
Yes.
Right? And the Court of Appeals says no dice. So the trial goes on. The statements are introduced in the state's case, right?
Yes.
And Anson takes the stand, right?
Right.
Okay. So now what you have is Anson has given testimony, just like Harrison, and we shouldn't confuse Harrison and Harris.
Right.
Okay. So now we've got it go to the Court of Appeals on a final judgment, and the court says, got a problem here.
Right.
We're suppressing these statements.
Right.
So, if you had a new trial, you have a problem because although the statements to the police are suppressed, you've got him giving sworn testimony.
Correct.
Right?
Right.
Just like in Harrison.
Right.
Okay. So now the problem is, can the state use this sworn testimony of Anson in the second trial?
Yeah, that's the
right?
Harrison question.
That's right. The Harrison question.
Right.
And that's where we're debating as to what the state has to prove at a Middleton-Harrison hearing
right. In
order to justify its using his prior testimony, right?
My understanding of Harrison-Middleton is that it's not a question of what they can use in the next trial. The question, it's a nunk-pro-tunk evaluation of whether he would have testified anyway, regardless of the use of the statements.
And then what do you do? So suppose you say he wouldn't have testified. Do you reverse the conviction? Do you ever get a new trial?
Yeah, I believe that if you conclude that he would not have testified
right.
at all, you reverse the conviction and send it back for a new trial.
New trial without his testimony, and you can't use his testimony
yeah.
again. So the
right.
state doesn't
yes.
have his statement
right.
and doesn't have his testimony.
In the
right.
new trial.
In the new trial.
Right.
So that's the whole point of the hearing, to see what the state's evidence can be in the new trial.
I don't believe that's correct.
Counsel.
But we're at that hearing to see whether or not
a new trial has to occur.
A new trial. Well,
we're here. The purpose of the Harrison-Middleton hearing, the way it's been perceived, the way I understand it, in the cases that I've been looking at, and I want to make it a little parenthetical here. Harrison is a very little used case for this purpose. Since 1968, I think the U.S. Supreme Court has only cited it 8 times, and I'm not even sure that even one of them has been for this purpose.
I understand.
Because there are other principles that for which it's better known. So there's very little guidance out there about what you do when you get back to this evaluation. My understanding, the way Middleton treated it, the way, and I think it was a fair reading of Harrison, is that the point of going back is to see whether the use of the state, whether the defendant testified for reasons other than, or that there were other reasons that overwhelmed the use of this testimony as the impetus for testifying. If the court finds that, then the second inquiry is that he would have testified. Then the second inquiry is, whether the statements that should not have come in would have nonetheless been repeated had he testified anyway.
And suppose they say it had been repeated.
That it would have been repeated? Then in effect, what they're saying is the conviction is good, and you reinstate the conviction.
Okay. Even though the suppressed statements have been knocked out, so do you use a harmless error test?
Well, that's not been an issue that's been briefed by anybody in this case.
I understand.
Okay. So, and that was one of the issues that I did want to get to because the proof issues sort of pervade this case. I found one case that analyzed Harrison in any detail that discussed the burden of proof and what standard to use. It's not a case that was cited in any of our briefs, but the Court of Appeals did cite it in the current opinion in Anson for a different proposition. It was only by sort of happenstance that I went back and read it and came in and discovered that there was much more to it than what the Court of Appeals said. This is a case of United States versus Palullo. It's cited at paragraph 21 of the second Anson opinion. It's a Third Circuit case decided in 1999. The site is 173 F3rd 131. Palullo says.
Repeat that. Sorry, I didn't get it.
Excuse me. It's United States versus Palullo.
Right.
Palullo, 173 F3rd 131.
Thanks a lot.
It's a Third Circuit case.
Can you spell Palullo?
Sure. P-E-L-U-L-L-O.
Thank you.
The Third Circuit went into a fairly extensive analysis of what Harrison actually means, what the fundamental nature of the Harrison holding is. And in Palullo, a Harrison hearing was held. This particular decision is the fourth Third Circuit opinion in Palullo. The third one, they sent it back for the kind of hearing that was done in this case. And Palullo is interesting on a number of levels. First of all, for the standard that they applied, they said that the state's burden was preponderance of the evidence. One of the reasons I didn't worry about the standard in this case was the judge said he was using proof beyond a reasonable doubt kind of standard. So that's the highest standard we can go for. I was content to live with that. But in preparing this, I realized that was not probably going to be satisfactory. And it happens that Palullo appears to be, it's been cited by one in connection with a Harrison type of issue that we're dealing with, has been cited by only one unpublished opinion. It came out of Northern District of Ohio and holds basically the same thing. Basically, what they did was they analogized this Harrison to an exclusionary rule case. He said, we believe the court in Harrison mandated what is essentially an exclusionary rule inquiry where there appears to be a link between a constitutional violation and a defendant's subsequent decision to take the stand. And then they went on and explained, and it's a very lengthy explanation, but in summary, what they did was they cited a number of the cases, Nix versus Williams, United States versus Matlock, Ligo versus Toomey, and they basically said that what we're really dealing with here is the state's response is analogous to inevitable discovery kind of response to an exclusion issue. And basically what the state is trying to show is he would have testified anyway. We would have had the evidence anyway, regardless of what the constitutional violation was. And what the Palullo court said was that in those cases, the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts, by necessity, have routinely applied a preponderance of the evidence test, not a harmless error test.
Mr. Rana, if I could, and I want to be, I'm not even sure I should ask this question, but I'm going to. Footnote 12 of Harrison sets forth the burden that the state has to reach, and it's just said that the state has the burden of proving that the defendant's testimony was not produced by the illegal use of his confession at trial. Compare Chapman versus California.
Right.
And what is the burden in Chapman?
Burden in Chapman is harmless error, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that you have to show that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
The fact that the U.S. Supreme Court is citing Chapman for the proposition of the burden doesn't that suggest then that the burden remains?
And the Third Circuit dealt with that. I mean, that was the issue. In fact, the defendant in Palullo raised that exact question, said the harmless error standard, citing Chapman, citing exactly what you cited. The Third Circuit goes into an extensive analysis of what was actually going on, what would actually go on in a Harrison hearing, and came to the conclusion that the Chapman reference wasn't real, that was not setting the standard. I see my time is running out, and it's a bit difficult to really summarize exactly what Palullo did, but I would urge you to read. It covers about three pages in the Reporter on analyzing that claim, analyzing the response.
Counsel, your time is running out. I want to get to, okay, you've got the hearing, whatever the standard, it's preponderance or whatever. How is the state to meet the standard? We have the Court of Appeals here suggesting that the state, in order to meet its burden, should be calling the defendant, should be calling the defense attorney. Is that how your Third Circuit treats it? How is the state to meet the burden? And does any other jurisdiction that's dealt with Harrison, you said it's been around for a while but not cited much in 68, does any other jurisdiction address this method of the state sustaining its burden?
Palullo, as far as I can tell, comes the closest. They remanded, and this is the second area where it's kind of interesting about what they did, because one of the big issues in this case was the whether it was permissible to rely on intangible factors in the case. Palullo essentially says, yes, it's permissible. This is, and I quote from the description of what the district court did on the remand to hold the Harrison hearing. And this is Palullo, pages 134 to 135 in the case. Quote, the government had to prove that Palullo's decision to testify at the first trial was not caused by the Brady violation. This is a different kind of violation. On remand, the district court held a hearing and made 69 findings of fact based on the evidence from the hearing, its review of the records of the first two trials, its observations of Palullo's demeanor at all four trials, and its analysis of Palullo's attorney testimony about strategy at the first trial. It doesn't say anything, as far as I could tell, about who has the burden of calling the attorney. I've laid out our position on the Fifth and Sixth Amendment issues. We just find it real difficult. If you want to say that it's okay for us to call it, that's fine. We just don't see a way consistent with protection of a defendant's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights that it can be done in this configuration of a case.
Is any other jurisdiction having the Harrison type of hearing addressed the defendant's testimony at this hearing?
In fact, Palullo is the only one that I've really seen a reference to where a hearing was held. I've looked around. I've tried various ways of locating this. Harrison frequently gets cited for a different proposition than what we're dealing with here. And in the ones where it has been cited for this proposition, I haven't seen anything in sort of the fact descriptions that suggest what they did in order to arrive at whatever conclusion they arrived at.
Well, maybe that. Now, you say Palullo went up and down four times?
This opinion is a fourth opinion.
And it was going to go back down, or is it finished?
I believe in this one it was finished. They affirmed the trial judge's finding that the guy would have testified and would have reined.
Maybe it's just easy to have a flat rule. If he testifies after a illegal statement is introduced by the state, that state can't use the illegal statement, state can't use his testimony, and you just start fresh. I mean, this sounds so complicated. Now, in this case, we're up for the third time, and you're saying it should go back again.
Well, I'm saying that what the court did was correct. I'm saying that if you decide that the procedures the court did not follow in this case were not correct, that the proper remedy, at least as we understand Harrison and Middleton, is to send it back for a new hearing, not for a new trial.
I understand that, but suppose if you're right that the state can't use the defendant or the defense counsel, how can the state prove what it has to prove, whether it's preponderance or beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, I think that goes to Justice Bradley's question.
No.
My answer is, they can call witnesses at this hearing to testify about some of these intangible things. I mean, that's what Palullo said, that the judge himself part of his findings were based on what he observed, which is what Anson, this decision in Anson, says he can't do. It can rely on the trial testimony and the proper inference and appropriate reasonable inferences from that trial testimony. When you look at the fact you've got three counts that he has to testify to as opposed to Harrison's one, there's a big incentive for him to testify about at least the two that aren't involved with this statement. And once he gets up on the stand, he doesn't have the privilege of not addressing the third count, which is where his statements then come in. So even if we don't call the defense counsel, even if we don't call the defendant, we still have an entire record to rely on, plus whatever record we can make at the evidentiary hearing about factors that bear on the defendant's decision to testify.
I have to do a lot of it on inferences.
Might be, but that's what. In fact, it's. I think it was in Middleton. The court said Middleton said why he testified is a fact which must be inferred from other evidence. And I think that's all we're asking to be allowed to do. Our reading of Anson, second opinion in Anson, is that the Court of Appeals changed these evidentiary standards by which you typically conduct evidentiary hearings. So we think that's incorrect.
Chief, if I may.
Mr. Justice Butler.
Mr. Wren, one of the concerns that I have, your argument seems to be premised upon the fact that because there was evidence, strong evidence, on counts one and two, the defendant would have had to have testified anyway. Now, my experience as both a criminal defense lawyer and a judge in trial practice has been that the general rule of thumb is, notwithstanding overwhelming evidence, if you put your client on the stand, you are taking a risk. And so the general advice is, regardless of what the evidence is, you at least advise the client, don't take the stand because you can hang yourself. That function shifts when there's a confession.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that be any different here?
Well, I think in part it's because whether that's your rationale or not, it's the trial judge's decision about what inferences to draw from the record about what the defendant would have done. What he would have done in this specific case as to what the general practice might be, I think is exactly what's left to the trial judge to infer what his state of mind was at that point. Part of the evidence that was presented at the hearing and part of the argument at this Harrison-Middleton hearing concerned all the reasons why he had an incentive to testify, including his personality, wanting to get him in front of the jury as a likable guy. And my understanding is he is a likable guy. So the judge heard that. The judge saw the trial. In fact, at one point, Mr. Watson, during this hearing, says, in objecting to Investigator Recknagel's testimony about the demeanor of the witnesses, Mr. Watson said, "We don't need this, Judge. You saw what went on at the trial." The use of intangible factors bear directly on what a defendant is going to do at a trial. And that's why I think it was incorrect for the Court of Appeals here to hold that you can't rely on intangible stuff, because that goes directly to the question that's at the heart of the Harrison-Middleton hearing. See, my time's up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Wren, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel Stephen J. Watson, representing Christopher Anson.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Steve Watson. I represent the defendant, Christopher Anson. I was co-trial with Attorney Larry Steen throughout this case. I would like to begin by just addressing some factors that are very critical for the Court to consider in this case, and that is the Attorney General's office has no standing to raise these issues of the constitutional rights of the defendant in this case. State versus Fisher clearly holds that only when a party's own rights are affected may a party have standing to raise constitutional issues. The state responds by saying the Mogilka versus Jekka case holds that when there's an interest in Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights, there could be standing. But the Mogilka case says, what's the injury in fact? There is no injury in fact to the state here. They lost a hearing. There is no injury in fact. What is the state's interest in protecting the defendant's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights? In this case, They're using the defendant's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights to get a new hearing with a more favorable standard. And you have to balance that self-serving interest of the state against the defendant's speedy trial rights. There have been 9 months that have gone by since this petition for review has been granted, since the second Anson case was decided.
Mr. Watson, before we even get to the question of whether the state has standing to raise your rights, isn't there the initial question of are you entitled to an evidentiary hearing in the first instance? In other words, when I read Harrison, when I read Middleton, and until we were just told about Palullo, I wasn't aware of any case that dealt with an evidentiary hearing on this basis. What is the, when you read Harrison, it seems to suggest that you look at the record. When you read Middleton, it seems to suggest that you look at the record. How do you get an evidentiary hearing? How do you even get to the point of whether or not your client or you as the attorney can be called?
I think Harrison is good law. I think, I mean, obviously, it's the established law. But I think that Harrison does not say what the procedure is, and I think absent that explanation or absent that direction, what applies are the fundamental standards that would apply in criminal procedure in any other case. The question that Harrison goes to, why did the defendant testify? That's the question that they're looking for. And I think that if you say there's no right to have a hearing on it, to an extent, you deprive the defendant in a case like this, where not only the record, but the statements to counsel and the discussions and everything else established beyond any question that his sole reason for testifying was the admission of this statement.
Well, if I could, first, as I read Middleton, I'm looking at page 320. Why he testified is a fact which must be inferred from other evidence. That's in citing Harrison. That's right at the bottom of page 320. The burden is not on the defense. It's on the state. Now, we may have to grapple with what the burden is, whether it's preponderance or whether it's reasonable doubt, but the burden is on the state. So I guess my question once again is, where do you get a procedural step that something other than looking at what happened in the trial court and looking at the evidence that's there, whether you get to intangibles or not is something we'll have to assess, but how do you get to, other than looking at what occurred in here, to determine whether or not the state has met its burden? It's the state's burden, not the defense's.
If you read Harrison in its language as why he testified as a fact to be inferred from other evidence, I don't know. I mean, if you read that literally to mean that that means no direct testimony, no direct evidence can be given, then indeed you do not get to an evidentiary hearing. I don't know how it should be read. I just know that the evidentiary hearing having been conducted, Mr. Anson decided, let's take the stand. Let's have the attorney testify as to why. This was something that was stated in the interlocutory appeal. The comment in the interlocutory appeal was that unless you grant this appeal, he's going to have to testify. The strategy will have to be that he's got to testify contrary to his right of silence. So if I may just continue with the standing issue, Mr. Anson doesn't claim any violation of his Fifth Amendment rights, doesn't claim any violation of his Sixth Amendment rights. He continues on probation. He continues under terms of conditions of probation. During the time that this petition for review was pending, because of California's sex offender law, his picture was pasted on a website, and he went back to his apartment building to find his picture pasted all over the halls of that website. While we are having an academic discussion about whether or not what would happen in future hearings, there's no case or controversy presented here. If at a subsequent hearing to Anson 2, a defendant says, the state calls the defendant, the defendant says, I invoke my right, and the trial court says, you have to testify anyway. Well, then there's a controversy. Then there's an issue. Here there is none. In addition, there is absolutely no basis in law for the state to argue that evidence outside of the record may be used to support a decision by a court at an evidentiary hearing, or that a judge may rely on his personal opinions as evidence supporting his decision. The reference to a defendant's demeanor is quite distinct. I mean, that has a tradition in criminal justice. That's quite distinct from a judge's personal opinions about things that were happening in the courtroom that were not even evidence, where somebody was not even on the stand, that had to do with family members. There is absolutely no basis for that. So we are now before the court without any issue, without the state having any standing or any basis, any good faith basis in law, to bring this before the court. And in the meantime, another 9 months go by, and this is a conviction that was entered in January of 2001. To address further some of the points of the state, I think that the danger is the state is arguing for an abridgment of the law of Harrison. They're saying a totality of the circumstances test should apply. Harrison is a narrow question. It places the burden on the state. The totality of circumstances cases where it's ineffective assistance of counsel or whether it's seek to withdraw a plea, there's a presumption immediately against the defendant, and the burden is on the defendant. When you've got ineffective assistance, you have to look at the whole record. In this case, you do not. And in this case, the Court of Appeals said you should look at everything. And what happened was the trial court wholesale took in the entire transcript over a hearsay objection and applied it against the defendant. So I would strongly urge the court not to abridge the constitutional protections in Harrison to allow a totality of the circumstances test to apply. The other thing that the state argues is that there should be another chance here. The court should be able to second guess how strong the defendant's why is. Is the defendant's why, is his reason good enough? And that's not what Harrison says. And in effect, the state is arguing there should be a shift in the burden of proof. There should be the first two prongs in the state's burden of proof. And then, even if the defendant does establish a link in fact, the court should evaluate, is that a legitimate enough why? Is that a legitimate enough reason? Is it an inconsequential reason, which basically puts the burden on the defendant at that point? And I would remind, or just repeat for the court, the language in Harrison: having illegally placed his confessions before the jury, the government can hardly demand a demonstration by the petitioner that he would not have testified as he did if his inadmissible confessions had not been used. The state is trying to shift that whole burden so that they get a second kick at the cat in the trial court. Again, with the Court of Appeals decision that defendant's testimony should be, you know, the state should be allowed to call the defendant and be allowed to call the defense attorney.
Well, let's stop right there, because what you just read would seem to suggest that the state can't. The defendant can't be compelled to present reasons.
I think that's correct.
So based upon that rationale, then the state can't call the defendant to the stand.
I don't think the state should. I object to that court. On the facts of this case, we chose to waive those protections because our reasons were so obvious they were established.
All right, so maybe I misunderstood. You and Mr. Wren agree on that point. State can't do that.
I certainly agree with that. I think that
I'll ask Mr. Wren when he comes back up.
I think that abridges Harrison, because that again accomplishes what you were talking about before. There your client is, whether or not it can be used in a later hearing, your client is exposed to yet another interrogation at a hearing designed to protect the violation of his rights to begin with, an illegal interrogation to begin with. He's now subjected to another interrogation, and maybe the state can or cannot use that at another hearing, but they're getting more information, they're building their case. So I believe that that's inappropriate.
Counsel, are you hanging most of your argument on the first part of Harrison, where it's a determination is first made that the defendant would not have testified but for the admission of this evidence, or are you also relying on the second part, which is more content-oriented, that if he testified, he wouldn't have testified in a way that would bring in all of the statements that were made to the officers?
I think the record overwhelmingly demonstrates that both apply. Certainly, he would not have repeated the inculpatory statements. It's important to remember there were three versions of this statement that were printed up and handed to the jury. As the investigator was flying from California to Wisconsin, he was making yet further corrections to portions of the tape which were inaudible. The tape was played to the jury. The jury was handed three separate exhibits of three different versions of this statement. To suggest that the defendant under those circumstances didn't have to get up and explain why, when the prosecutor in the end of her opening argument said his hand was placed on her for 3 minutes, to suggest that when the statement has an audible portion, contrary versions, and the defendant has no choice but to get up and testify in a situation like that, he would not have repeated. What reason would he have to repeat, "I lied to my wife"? How would that have come in? Simply not relevant. What he had to explain, why he said she had grounds. He had to get up and explain why he would have said to the police that she had grounds for his allegations, for her allegations. How would that have come in otherwise? He had to get up and explain the lie to his wife, and he also had to explain the comment, the reference to the time period, which was a matter of dispute because of the quality of the tape. I believe, I'm not yet sure what the State is arguing, because the State in its briefs argues that there should be a remand and a second hearing. We're opposed to that. I just want to touch a little bit more on this wholesale admission of hearsay evidence. If you allow an evidentiary hearing and allow all this stuff, all the transcripts to come in, what you wind up with is a trial. And that's what happened at this evidentiary hearing. There was, in effect, a second trial. Witnesses were sworn. The entire trial transcript was received in evidence over objection. The judge made determinations of the credibility of witnesses in those transcripts, and the judge entered a finding of guilt. That goes so far beyond the what Harrison suggests that I believe that it subjected Mr. Anson to a second trial. And I think that double jeopardy, direct estoppel, prevent a further hearing, and I think it would be manifest injustice to require a further hearing. There was a question of constitutional fact that was found by the Court of Appeals, and that was the State did not meet its burden of proof to overcome the natural inference that he would not have taken the stand and repeated those inculpatory statements.
Counselor, so what you want us to do then is to order a new trial where these statements are suppressed. Is that what you're asking for?
I am requesting that the court hold that this appeal had no merit, the State had no standing, that it was a violation of Mr. Anson's speedy trial rights, that the case should thereby therefore be dismissed.
So you don't want a new trial?
Well, in the alternative, yes. But I believe that these are issues that arose by the whole question of the defendant's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights never arose until this petition for review. And they've now taken 9 months out of this man's life. And he didn't raise them. And they're not the State's to raise. The defendant is also requesting the costs and attorney's fees be assessed against the State. With respect to the reference to Palullo and the intangibles, I think that 906.05, the rules of evidence, a judge is not competent to testify as a witness. That's what really happened here. And there is no basis to allow a judge to have his own sense of what's going on become a finding of fact that is then used against a defendant in a hearing on a constitutional violation.
Well, doesn't a judge have to make a decision based upon the record before the court as to whether or not the State has met its burden of proof?
Yes, it does, but the family demeanor was not in the record. The divisiveness and the tension between the family that the judge observed in the courtroom, it was not in the record. And who's to say that that tension was directed against the defendant? Who's to say it was not directed against the victim? Who knows? And that's the whole problem with it. That's why we have evidentiary hearings and a record.
You don't have a, or do you have a problem? Maybe it's the way I should ask it. Do you have a problem with the trial court using all of the evidence that was introduced during the course of the trial in order to make its determination?
If that excludes the defendant's right to, as he may choose, present his own direct testimony, then I would object to it. Otherwise, and if...
But what should the court consider then?
I think it is up to the state with the burden of proof to produce that evidence to, in ways that are admissible and permitted under the rules of evidence, to establish its burden that the defendant wouldn't have done it, to establish its burden that the defendant would have gotten up anyway and would have repeated those statements. I don't know what that evidence is. I mean, I'd have to think about it, and the prosecutor would have to think about it and interview witnesses.
So you're still arguing, you want the separate hearing, and you would argue that other than that which is introduced in the separate hearing, the court can't consider the rest of the trial testimony and the rest of the evidence introduced in making its determination. Is that your position?
Well, I think not. What I'm really arguing is that on these facts, the Court of Appeals has ruled as a matter of law that as a constitutional fact, the defendant would not have gotten up on the stand and repeated these statements. The issue of what should happen at an evidence, and I'm arguing that, therefore, this case should be done.
Yeah, but that's how the Court of Appeals held, that the case should be dumped. It said it should be a new trial.
Correct.
So you don't support the Court of Appeals' decision here?
I don't support the court. Well, I guess I'm arguing in the alternative. I believe that that if not dismissed, and I don't expect it to be dismissed, it should be remanded for a new trial. The question of can the court consider the record, I guess, I really don't know how to answer that, because I think the narrow question is, why did he testify? And if the court wants to consider that, I think the defense has a right to object to it. I don't know that issue has been determined. The problem is you sometimes could wind up with a judge who's looking through a record, and again, you're losing your right of confrontation because you don't have any control over the inferences that he's drawing. You don't have any opportunity to cross-examine witnesses. And I think the reason that I would argue that just a review of the record is not sufficient is because the defendant begins a Harrison hearing at a disadvantage, having been harmed by the use of an illegal confession. And I think he should have the opportunity to challenge any suggestion that he would have testified anyway and that he would have repeated the other facts. If he just has a hearing, if the judge just does a paper review, I think he loses that challenge.
As I understand the posture of the case, the Court of Appeals said no second hearing at the trial court. We just go to a new trial, right? And at the new trial, the statements to the police were suppressed, right? And he can't use this testimony, right? Okay. And in your petition to your response to the petition to review is that's the way it should stand, and that the state has no standing to debate these constitutional issues as to the evidence.
Yes.
Therefore, the court should not handle that in this case.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's still your position.
Well, I'm assuming that there's going to be a decision. And if,
who am I, but don't bet on it.
And if there is, I think that the Court of Appeals held in ways that are not supported by Harrison and abridged rights
and protections. And in that sense, you agree with the state. So you don't like that opinion either, except for maybe the bottom line, you're not so sure about that either.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
What about the concept in the Court of Appeals, Court of Appeals opinion, that it was harmless error to introduce this illegal statement when the defendant testified? And that's what the Court of Appeals held. Do you agree with that?
Do you mean the Court of Appeals second analysis in its opinion where it says we found the statement inadmissible, now we turn to the question as to whether or not it's harmless error?
Yeah. And it says it's not harmless error. It says it is harmless error.
I believe that the Court of Appeals says it is not harmless error.
Well, if it was not harmless error
That it was not harmless error, but it still needed to be remanded for a factual determination as to why he testified.
Right. But if it's prejudicial to have introduced this illegal statement, even when he testified, why isn't that a total wash for that conviction?
I think the answer is because the Court of Appeals looked at the case of Harrison and said, this is binding precedent, and we must address this question.
Right. Good, because if there's a finding that this testimony was not impelled, then the result is that first conviction stands, even though there was illegal statements introduced, right?
Yes, and that seems unfair.
Seems contradictory to me.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wren.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Couple of things that I'd like to address. In regard to the Fifth and Sixth Amendment issue, the reason it wasn't raised earlier was because it first came up in the Court of Appeals. It was not briefed. That issue was not briefed by anybody at any previous stage. The state has an interest, and I'll rely on my reply brief for that statement about why we have standing to try to determine what that line is, whether we're going to cross it or not. I don't think there's any rule that says in order to have standing to ask the court to address an issue like this, that we have to go out and affirmatively try to violate the Constitution, which is what we believe would happen in the configuration of this kind of case.
Well, does it appear to you that at least on the issue of whether the state can call counsel, defense counsel, or the defendant, that there's an agreement between you, which doesn't bind the court because it's a law conclusion?
I don't know whether he actually agrees or not. I mean, they waived it, but that doesn't go to the question of whether we can compel.
Right.
And the Court of Appeals implies that we can compel the defendant and defense counsel to appear over their objection. We're not convinced that that's constitutional. And I don't see that it's incumbent on the state to try to violate the Constitution. That's a very odd kind of standing doctrine.
In fact, you would welcome the opportunity to do that, wouldn't you?
Well, some people would. I don't know that I would, but certainly it puts us in this is a very odd configuration to me, that we're arguing to say we want to know what the constitutional limits are, and Mr. Anson appears to be saying we don't care what the constitutional limits are.
I don't think that was his position. I think he said that he agrees with you that the state cannot call him. He said what he did is he waived it and he believed he had the right to do that.
Well, he can waive it if he puts on his own testimony, but if his argument is that we can call regardless of waiver, I don't think he agrees with that. We don't know that he's waived it any more than we know at a trial whether a defendant's going to waive the right until we complete our case. Same kind of thing here. We can't know that. If he wants to waive it, that's perfectly fine, but if the idea is that we are then somehow obliged to call, we have to know about that waiver ahead of time.
I see.
And we don't get that waiver notice. The other thing has to do with the intangibles. From our point of view, and I hope I made this point earlier, is that the court did not rely on the intangibles to find that there was a distinguished basis in terms of Harrison. The court specifically said that the distinguished basis was the pressure from the testimony that was given by the witnesses. That was the distinguished basis that he relied on. The references to demeanor and these other things were essentially after the fact. They were kind of make-weeks. They were kind of buttressing the point that there was lots of stuff going on, but it was the testimony of the witnesses that put the pressure on. That was his finding of fact. And I don't think the Court of Appeals had any authority to make a contrary finding of fact on that. That was based on credibility of testimony. Mr. Watson can say there was that the evidence is overwhelming. The Court basically said, I don't believe Mr. Steen. I don't believe that this was the only reason he testified. I simply don't believe it. And he said, despite what Mr. Steen says, that was the Court's comment. This does not shift the burden to the defendant.
Is that a finding of fact or a finding of constitutional fact?
When the Court says, despite what Mr. Steen says, I think it's making a credibility judgment about what the state of mind was of the defendant. I think that's a finding of fact. And that finding of fact then goes to the question of whether you have a constitutional finding of fact at that point. But that finding of fact about his state of mind is relegated to the trial court. And I think that supports the conclusion that he would have testified and that it would have followed that he would have testified that these statements would have come in any event.
Mr. Wren, the Chief Justice threw out the idea of a bright-line rule of not allowing any testimony by the defendant. What's your reaction to that?
I don't think it was a bright-line rule about, you mean just send it back if there's a claim of a Harrison violation that basically goes back? Well, in effect, that from our point of view, that just nullifies Harrison and Middleton. If the finding that the statement should have been suppressed and that he testified after the statement came in results in an irrebuttable presumption, then we don't have Harrison or Middleton.
That's what I'm suggesting.
Yes.
Just cut it out.
I understand that. And I don't think that's what Harrison is implying.
I accept that.
Yeah.
We're in a new area. Out of the box.
Sure. And if you impose that rule, I think that's a rule that you would do you would have to do independent of whatever the Harrison and Middleton rule is.
Right.
And I don't know where that rule would come from other than simply judicial fiat.
Sounds good. What's the matter with it?
Because I don't think that gets the question that Middleton and Harrison were all about, which is why did he testify?
I understand that, but if it creates this much problem.
I think the only reason it creates this problem is because we didn't have rules before. Part of the point of the decision of this Court would be to help flesh out those rules. I think Pelullo helps do that. And once we have those rules in place, then I don't think we get these multiple appeals of this sort. I don't think you get the multiple appeals in Pelullo in that case.
Took a few shots to get the rules, apparently.
Well, Pelullo was kind of a complicated case, apparently, for a lot of reasons, and this being
one of them.
So, anyway, thank you very much. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Wren, and thank you, Mr. Watson, for your arguments in a novel case, which hasn't come before this Court, and apparently not very many other courts. That ends the hearing in 03-1444-CR. And the students who wish to remain and others may do so. And Justice Bradley will be out momentarily to talk with you about the procedure of the case. Court's in recess till 1:30 when we'll hear its third case today.